This week on the show, we recap the Patriots' big win down in the Bayou with CSN New England's Phil Perry. Matt McCarthy of 98.5 joins us to talk Red Sox, and we go through a wild weekend in sports. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Well, Levelitz, it's a lot better to record this show on a Monday when the Patriots win. This is the Calling It podcast, and feeling good. A little less traffic, sun's a little brighter, coming off a win.
Yeah, Brady looked better. Everyone looked better. Gronk had a great game, got a little banged up, but it's a good sign for Pats fans.
Here to help break down the big win from Comcast Sportsnet New England is Phil Perry. He joins us on the phone. Phil, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
All right, so the big question today, we've got two sample sizes, the game against the Chiefs and the game against the Saints. Which is a better representation? Which told you more about the 2017 New England Patriots early in the season?
Man, it's an awesome question. I don't think we can look at either game in a vacuum and say, okay, this is who the Patriots are. But here are a couple factors that we have to weigh every time we watch this team play. A, where are they health-wise? And the picture isn't all that great following that Saints game, as nice as that win was and as dominant as they looked at times. The other thing we have to look at is the level of competition. Listen, that Chiefs team that the Patriots played in week one may end up being one of the top contenders in this conference by season's end. Can we say the same thing about the Saints in the NFC at the end of the season? I don't think so. That defense is too young. They have too many issues already on that offensive line. I just don't think that's a very good football team down in New Orleans that the Patriots just beat. Now, am I taking something away from the Patriots by dismantling them the way they did? No, you have to give them credit. But I think, listen, there's a lot we have to factor in every time we watch this team. I will say an encouraging sign just that, A, they were able to respond the way they did after a crushing defeat in that season opener, where you had a lot of people in that locker room questioning what the team had in terms of its character. And B, just yet another sign that Bill Belichick's team is going to improve with every week in certain facets. Now, there's still plenty of room for improvement going into week three against the Texans, but a much better showing top to bottom in week two than in week one. And I would expect that they'll have some things cleaned up even by week three when they play the Houston, when they play the Houston Texans at home.
How worried should we be about Rob Gronkowski at this point? Seems first two games he's gotten banged up on a few plays, and he seems more injury prone at this point in his career. How concerned should we be about Gronk, and how do you see the Patriots managing him moving forward?
Always have to be concerned about this guy. Anytime he leaves a game injured, anytime he even gets up slowly, the litany of injuries that he's gone through over the course of his career is too long just to overlook something like that and say, well, he'll be fine. He's half man, half machine. He'll come back the next week, and he'll be an all-pro tight end yet again. Now, what's interesting is that he has made a lot of changes to, you know, not only his game. You know, he's talked about in the past about living to see the next play and, you know, maybe trying to go down sometimes a little bit quicker than maybe he would have when he was younger. Now, that didn't happen against the Saints. I thought that might be a situation where, you know, he basically was carrying one defender as he was about to be tackled by another. And it's really hard for him to kind of balance the, okay, how do I know when to play it safe versus be myself and be that one-man wrecking crew that's going to be able to run over people in the secondary. That's a really tough balance to strike. But the off-the-field stuff, too, is something that he's really focused on in terms of changing the workout regimen a little bit, changing the diet a little bit. This isn't a complete overhaul. I know a lot has been made of the fact that he's now on the Tom Brady diet, and he is at times, but he's not Tom Brady in that regard. But it is one of the things that he's tried to do to make himself a little bit more durable to try to avoid some of the issues that he's run into in the past. And you said it, now it's 2 weeks in a row where we're watching this guy slow to get up off the turf, talking to trainers, sitting on the bench, talking to the team physician. And so it's a groin injury. I know the initial results, it sounds like, are that it's not all that serious, but we're going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to wait and see what this injury report looks like during the week, see how limited he is in practice. But the reason you're more concerned now about Rob Gronkowski than maybe ever is that the surrounding cast is banged up too. And so if you lose him, you're just down another body, and the Patriots are looking at a passing game right now where it might be Brandon Cooks and James White and Deion Lewis and not a whole heck of a lot else. Chris Hogan's banged up. We know all the injuries that Danny Amendola is dealing with. So if you lose Rob Gronkowski, it's maybe an even more significant blow than usual.
A name that got thrown around on Twitter a lot after the game yesterday was Anquan Boldin, who started training camp with the Bills, then retired. What are the chances that Belichick is going to go either with him or somebody else outside the organization if the prognosis isn't good on Dorsett, Hogan, whoever it may be?
Yeah, Bolden's unlikely because he retired with the Bills, and the Bills still basically own his contract. So what would happen if Bolden wanted to come back would be that, you know, basically what happens if you're retired and you're under contract, your contract basically freezes. And so if you want to come back, it gets unfrozen and it's still owned by the team that you were initially under contract with. So the Bills would have to release him to allow him to play for the Patriots, which doesn't seem all that likely in the division, or they would have to trade him again in the division. Not all that likely. So I'm not sure that's, you know, necessarily all that likely. But looking outside the organization, sure. You know, you're probably not going to get anyone, I would say even on the Philip Dorsett level, where, you know, somebody who's a former first-round pick without trading a significant asset. But, you know, they are constantly searching around the league, around, you know, the free agent waiver wire, those types of things. That's what Nick Caserio and his team are doing day and night to try to find ways to help this team. And the way the receiver group is currently constructed, that's certainly going to be an area that they focus on. The other place I would say to keep an eye on two guys is the practice squad. These are guys that have been with the team, you know, for months in some cases and weeks in others. There's two receivers on that practice squad right now. One's Cody Hollister, special teamer slash receiver out of Arkansas. So, you know, his kick coverage experience might give him some value that the Patriots like. So maybe you see somebody like him get called up. The other name is DeMarcus Ayers. He's much more new to the team, did not spend training camp with the team, but he has some punt return experience. So that's another name to keep an eye on. He's a punt returner slash receiver.
You mentioned maybe the need to trade something big if they want to go out and get a quality wide receiver. Something else that caught the eye of a lot of people watching the game yesterday, Malcolm Butler and Alan Branch did not play a lot. It didn't look to be health-related. Reports coming out now, it was matchup-based. The Saints have some bigger wide receivers in terms of not paying Butler. But Butler specifically, not as much Branch. Was this a benching? Was this a strategy thing? Or are they getting ready to maybe move this guy if they need, given he's in the last year of his contract?
No, I think it was matchup-based. Listen, I think the Patriots really let us know how they feel about Malcolm Butler, and this is, you know, not all that new with the way that they played him the other day. It's just he doesn't do well against big receivers. It's not taking all that much away from Malcolm Butler, but it's just a fact. He's not a big guy. He, you know, when the Jets were running out Eric Decker and Brandon Marshall, he really struggled in those games. So they look at it and they say, well, we have 2 6-foot-plus corners on our team and Eric Rowe and Stephon Gilmore, so why would we run out the 5'10" guy on 6'3" Michael Thomas or 6'6" Brandon Coleman? Those are their top two receivers in New Orleans, and when Ted Ginn was on the field in three receiver sets, when the Patriots wanted three corners out there, Malcolm Butler was out there. Malcolm Butler ended up playing more snaps than Eric Rowe in that game because Rowe left injured, but I really do think it was a matchup thing. This is a matchup, you know, in terms of playing bigger receivers, it's a matchup that they've tried to avoid in the past. And so that didn't shock me yesterday when he didn't start and when you saw Eric Rowe on the field early in that game. I don't know if they are getting ready to trade him. I've been saying since training camp that I would not be shocked, you know, whether it was in camp or right up until the trade deadline, if they traded Malcolm Butler, because this is exactly the kind of guy that they have been willing to move in the past. Young and talented and someone that it looks like they're probably not going to be willing to pay down the line, that's a trade asset, especially at that position. That's, you know, there's significant value in having an elite guy like Malcolm Butler around the league. There are plenty of teams that could use top-tier corners, and so I still would not be shocked if they traded him at some point, even if it was in season. We saw what happened with Jamie Collins last year. So, you know, people may not like the return that you get because you're giving him up at this point for less than a full season left on his contract. But I would not be shocked if they dealt him at some point. Now, if the cornerback position continues to deal with injuries, I would be surprised because they're looking a little bit banged up right now. Eric Rowe left that game with an injury. Stephon Gilmore was limping in the locker room after the game. So some issues there to be ironed out. But I think yesterday, if we're just looking at yesterday, I'm not considering the trade, the potential of a trade being the reason why he didn't start. I think it was more the size of New Orleans receivers.
And we're talking to Phil Perry of CSN New England. Phil, before we let you go, we have to touch on Dietrich Weiss Jr. Last night, another sack, second straight week with the sack. One, do you expect him to sustain this play? And two, with him and Trey Flowers on the edge, how much flexibility does that give them in the linebacking core once Dont'a Hightower does come back?
Man, I really like Dietrich Weiss. I think, you know, even going back to the pre-draft process, he was a guy I highlighted as a perfect Patriots fit. Because if you look at the numbers, Dietrich Weiss at the combine, Chandler Jones at the combine, it is scary how similar those two guys were, not only just in terms of the size, the height, and the weight, but the arm length, the hand size. You know, we're getting down into the really minute details of these players and their physical makeups. You know, the three cone times, the 40 times, the vertical leap. These guys were very close to identical coming out of college. And the reason why Dietrich Weiss wasn't considered to be really a higher draft pick, you know, talking to some people around the league, some talent evaluators, coaches, he was injured. His last season at Arkansas had a hand injury, really limited the way he was able to play. And I think it took away from some of his explosiveness on the field. That's really one of his strong suits is his punch at the line of scrimmage. He's a really strong kid. He's really long. So he's able to really disrupt offensive linemen right off the snap. And he wasn't able to do that his last year at Arkansas. So I think that allowed him to slip. The Patriots pounced. And they have a very physically developed rookie who has clearly been ready to go from week one. Even in training camp, guys, he stood out as somebody who was going to be able to make an impact right away. He got concussed in that first preseason game against the Jaguars, so he sort of fell off the radar for a few weeks. But he was one of their best defensive linemen, rookie or otherwise, to start training camp. And so this is somebody who I think they're going to be able to depend on as the year goes along. In terms of how it impacts the linebacker group, you know, he's an interesting guy in that, you know, very much like Chandler Jones. Chandler Jones was not somebody that you wanted in coverage. And so, you know, I'm not sure that he necessarily will disrupt the rotation at outside linebacker at all. You're still going to need players like Hightower. You know, I think they think that Cassius Marsh can be this type of player in some ways because he's a pretty good athlete. You still need guys who can drop. And that's not really Dietrich Weiss's game. He's going to be an up-the-field player. You're going to see him, you know, playing maybe inside a little bit for snaps where it's more likely that the opposition is going to run the football. You'll see him outside or inside as a pass rusher. But he's not really going to factor into that linebacker mix on the edge there. You're not going to really see him standing up, I don't think, all that much on the edge. So he's good for what he is right now. I think they like him in the obvious passing situations as a pass rusher, and he could develop to be more of a well-rounded guy. But right now, in the role that they have him in, he's not going to be seeing quite as extensive snaps as somebody like Hightower would when he's healthy. And that's okay with them. If he can give them what he's given them the last 2 weeks, even in limited snaps, they'll take that.
You can watch Phil Perry on Comcast Sportsnet New England. You can also follow him on Twitter at Phil A. Perry. Phil, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
All right, so the Patriots go down to the Bayou. They pick up the win. Not a city that's been kind to them. 1-2 all-time in Super Bowls down there.
Yeah.
People don't realize they played their first three Super Bowls in the Superdome. Got shellacked by the Bears. Lost late against the Packers. And, of course, we all know what happened in Super Bowl 36. But the focus is on yesterday afternoon. And what I didn't realize until we got into the fourth quarter was one of the greatest games of Tom Brady's career.
Low key was.
It was really, really low key. And I throw the term low key around a lot, but you didn't. He played. I recognized he was playing well, very well.
Yeah.
But I think maybe just because of what happened last week, all of a sudden they say fourth most career passing yards, first time he's thrown three touchdowns in the first quarter, biggest first quarter start they've had. Maybe it's because he's always doing that at the end,
yeah,
and not at the beginning of games. But and I said it last week, there were a lot of people to be worried about after that game against the Chiefs. The one person I was not worried about and I was not going to be close to being worried about was Tom Brady, because he has a history of turning it around after a bad performance, and he did it yesterday. I know that's a bad Saints defense. I understand that there are some outside reasons besides Brady why he played so well, but on the road against an NFL defense, he went in and he tore them apart.
Yeah, that's exactly what you expect from Tom Brady, even at this point in his career. When they get beat like they did against Kansas City, they're going to come back and respond, and that's exactly what happened. And it's not just Tom Brady. It's a game plan thing. You have to give credit to Josh McDaniels. He had a much better game.
Oh, they not only had a better game plan, they made adjustments. Things that they had wanted to do didn't work, or they couldn't do because of injuries, and they changed it up. Tony Romo, who was great, and I loved listening to as a color analyst, brought up a great point. They were running essentially a version of the offense they ran in 2001 when Brady was first taking over.
Yeah.
It's simplified. It's not based on just being better than the other team, which is what we thought they would do with this talent they have on the field. There's a lot of deception. They ran, what, 4 or 5 end-arounds? Mm-hmm. They were using bubble screens, motion, putting wide receivers in the backfield. That's not something that they planned on going into this year. I love to see that. I hope we see more of it, and that's not just the nostalgia in me.
Yeah, it was very unorthodox. That's literally what I wrote in my notes. I talk about the end-arounds and just the unorthodox play calling on the offensive side of the ball. Plenty of end-arounds. One play that stuck out to me is the fake screen, then Hogan on the slant. That was an amazing
play. I loved that, and they sold it with the pump fake.
Yep.
If you saw, I had on Twitter this weekend, I was calling the game MIT football against Endicott. They ran the exact same play. They had run, I think, 10 bubble screens in a row before that play. The quarterback pumped and hit a guy wide open down the sideline. So I don't know. I saw it, and it works at all levels.
And there's also the one where Devlin was out wide, and then was it Hogan? Hogan on the somewhat of a wheel route, and he was wide open in the end zone for the touchdown.
I love them putting Devlin out wide.
And he just stood there. The Raiders did it last week with Marshawn Lynch. I recognized it. This week, James Devlin was Marshawn Lynch for the Patriots and just stood there. He didn't even move. Just to draw the guy in.
It's an extra coverage guy, and sometimes you're not realizing this is the fullback. Your assignment is to line up on the guy out wide. You're going to take a cornerback away. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to run the ball, you're taking a linebacker away from the box by putting Devlin outside. They used to do it, going back to the 2001 offense, with Antoine Smith on a regular basis. They would line him out wide. I know Thanksgiving game against the Lions, not in 2001, but a couple of years later, I think he had 10, 12 snaps in that position, did Antoine Smith. So I like them doing that. I liked it, and again, Romo was great on it. A lot of my takes today are going to be formulated by Tony Romo, because I just thought he was awesome. But they're doing things that other teams just don't do, and by nature of that, they're not going to be ready for.
Yeah, they have to resort to it. That's the thing. This isn't the ideal Patriots system. This is something they're doing because they're dealing with a plethora of injuries, and they have no other choice, and this is what works. And Because they implemented this game plan, one, it caught the Saints off guard, I think, and two, they scored, 44 points? So they killed it. And, it's crazy how when they have to resort to a certain style of offense, they still manage to, have a record-breaking day.
We've seen them do this with the defense before, too. Mm. It's not actually uncommon for them. Remember back in 2004 when Asante Samuel went down, Ty Law went down, they had Troy Brown playing corner, Earthwin Moreland, Hank Poteet. They've done this before with the defense. It's the first time I can recall them doing it with the offense, and it's working. One more thing about Devlin before we move on. I love that Belichick made the fullback position extinct. He was really the first one that kind of went away from that and started going to the spread. And now that everybody else has stopped using it, he's going to bring it back.
It's a zombie position. That's what it is. And correction, 36. It was 36 and 20.
Because Gronk dropped that touchdown, and you're still trying to react to how that's possible. One more thing about the offense before we switch sides of the ball. I was big on Philip Dorsett. I liked the trade when they made it. We didn't see him week one. I wasn't surprised he hadn't been in the system. I was, again, I got to go back to the 2001 offense. I got a text from my brother during the game. Philip Dorsett is the new David Patton. And boy, is that a fit.
Yeah.
Maybe a little quicker, but I loved the way they were using him. The one play that stood out to me, Brady wanted to throw a deep ball to him down the right side. I think this was in the second half. It was either the very end of the first half or in the second half. And he was in double coverage. Dorsett was. Brady had some pressure. He couldn't put the ball over the top. He left it short. Dorsett knew to come back to the ball, and he made the catch falling down. I think you know what play I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, a lot of receivers do not make that play. That is a difficult play to make. Him and Brady are starting to get on the same page, clearly. You add that to the deep ball he caught contested down on the goal line in double coverage. I think he's just going to get better and better and better as the year goes.
He had a better game than Cooks.
He did. And I thought Cooks was, again, Brandon Cooks hasn't stood out on the stat sheet, but you watch the coverages he draws, the penalties he draws. He's been as advertised to me, but I can't wait to, if this is Dorsett in week 2, I can't wait to see him week 10.
The one thing I am worried about, though, is Cooks had problems in New Orleans. And to be honest, I don't know all the details of what went on there. If he's not getting the ball a ton, does there start to become a little bit of a rift between him and the Patriots coaching staff? Does he become unhappy, or does he just care about winning?
I mean, I think what it sounded like to me was he wasn't the one who was unhappy about the touches. It was another wide receiver on that team, but they ultimately decided to trade Cooks and keep the other guy.
Okay.
I don't think Belichick would have made the trade if Cooks was the instigator. Because him and Sean Payton are tight. I'm sure he could find out if he wanted to. And if you ask me, the Saints kept the wrong guy, and we saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Because Michael Thomas was not great. And he's a good player, but I didn't think he was great in this game. But don't be fooled. And we talked about, before we get to the defense, I know the Saints' defense is bad and Brady took them apart. That's a good Saints offense that the defense stopped. That, I think that is a better offense than Kansas City has, frankly. And you're rolling your eyes at me. I don't know.
I'm thinking about it. I think they just played a Kansas City team that executed and played really well.
Alex Smith had the best game of his life, but still, I think the best game of Alex Smith's life is an average game for Drew Brees. Look at the numbers. They were similar, but the difference is the Patriots made the stops when it mattered. They couldn't get off the field on third down against the Chiefs. I think the Chiefs only had 2 third down conversions in that game. They stopped them on fourth down a couple of times. And that's Drew Brees. That's not a scrub quarterback. Again, Michael Thomas wasn't great because the coverage was good. He shouldn't have been taken away by a guy like Stephon Gilmore, by a guy like Eric Rowe, but he was. Alvin Kamara, they neutralized him outside of maybe 2 plays. Also, buddy, nose ring during a football game? That's a bold I thought it was a glare on his shield for the longest time. That's a bold choice. No, they neutralized a good offense by going at the weakness, which was the offensive line. This is what they've done before. They couldn't attack the weakness for the Chiefs, which was the secondary wide receivers, because they couldn't stop the primary. They made the game from the defensive game plan about the Saints' offensive line, and they couldn't answer.
Yeah, the pass rush was great, and I can't get over it enough. Dietrich Weiss, we talked about Phil Perry. He looked really,
really legit.
Good. And that Chandler Jones prototype, he's been unbelievable. And it's amazing timing, because that's like the one void the Patriots needed to fill. And we thought we might be getting that with Derek Rivers. He's out for the season. I don't think anyone expected Weiss to come in and do what he's done so far. And once you have him and Flowers paired up, who are doing a very good job early on in the season.
Trey Flowers, I think, had a sack yesterday. He looked good. He was in there a couple times.
But it becomes almost a strength of your defense, dare I say?
Yeah.
And that, who would have thought 3 weeks ago that we'd be saying that?
I've been in on this pass rush, and I said it from the top. Cassius Marsh looked better yesterday because they actually used him as a pass rusher and not a linebacker. I know Phil said they like him in coverage, but for the most part, he was going after the quarterback, which looked good. They went smaller on the defensive line, which you need to do against New Orleans without Allen Branch. Thought Malcolm Butler did a good job in the middle. Malcolm Brown. Adam Butler, though, looked really good yesterday.
Yeah.
You want to talk about rookies, and Wise probably was the best rookie on the field yesterday for the Patriots. But Adam Butler, he was in Breeze's face a couple times. I don't think he got a sack. The one play that I loved from him, and I've talked about his athleticism a couple of times on this show, it was an incompletion on a screen, but you couldn't tell it was close. And Butler, even though there were 5 players closer, fell on the ball right on the sideline. And to see that kind of awareness from a guy who's coming in as an undrafted rookie, I love it. I think this guy's going to have a long, successful career in New England, just based on what I've seen from a couple of games.
Yeah, he's been very good the first couple of weeks. And usually you see the Pats get an undrafted rookie who comes in and will contribute. They have like at least one every year.
Yep.
Maybe not contributes at a high level, but it's still on the 53-man roster, does something, whether special teams, defense. You never see it with that many linemen, though. Like I can't remember the last time they got an undrafted rookie who has done as much as Adam Butler has done in the first couple weeks of the season.
As a lineman?
As a lineman. Off the top of my head, I can't. So to see someone come in, because that's usually a position where you judge, speed, first step, strength. He slipped through the cracks, and the Pats landed on someone who's been an instant contributor, which is huge.
And what'd you think of that secondary yesterday? I think the reason they didn't play Malcolm Butler was strategy. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's still alarming to me because even against bigger receivers last year, they would put him out on the field. Now, maybe having Stephon Gilmore changes that. But if I'm Malcolm Butler, I'm a little worried in terms of my standing on this team because had one of the best games yesterday?
Jonathan Jones.
Jonathan Jones apparently is the second coming of Deion Sanders. And I did not know this. And I don't think anybody knew that.
Yeah, I was unaware.
They should just let him return punts.
Yeah.
Complete the thing. Give him a do-rag and let him prime time into the end zone.
Yeah, a baseball glove on top of that. He's been very good. And I don't think it's a slight at Malcolm Butler. I don't think it's,
not a slight, but if you're hoping to get paid, here's a guy that can just step right into your role.
I mean, that could be true. He had a rough preseason, and last week he was all right. But if you have a guy in Jonathan Jones who can get the job done and fill in that void, at the very least, you're sending a slight message.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just, we have someone behind you who comes from exactly where you come from. You're an undrafted rookie. You were an undrafted rookie. This guy's undrafted. He's not a rookie, but he's an undrafted guy as well in his second season. He could take your position. You know this as well as anyone. It could be that. I don't think so. I think it was a strategy thing. He's not the biggest of cornerbacks, so I just think they didn't want to throw him out there against guys who, had 3-4 inches on him.
He has historically, except from the preseason this year, historically played very well against the Houston Texans. So it will be interesting to see what they do next week. If he plays his normal role, okay, it was a game plan thing. If he's not on the field next week, I think it's maybe a Jabal Sheard kind of thing.
All they have to do against the Houston Texans is put someone on. Put all your cornerbacks on DeAndre Hopkins.
No respect for C.J. Fedorowicz.
You know what? I don't think I have that much respect for him. But they're not throwing to anyone besides Hopkins, so I'm not worried about that.
I will, bringing up C.J. Fedorowicz, I will say one guy who concerned me yesterday was Patrick Chung, and that's the second week in a row.
Yeah, he got beat.
First Patriot stint, Patrick Chung, number 25, Patrick Chung, right, was his first stint.
Mm-hmm.
Could not cover
a
lick. He was a linebacker. Went to Philly, came back. He's been better in coverage. He was great in coverage last year, but he got beat a couple times yesterday. He got beat a couple times in the opener, and I was wondering why we didn't see Daron Harmon on the field. Another thing I'm watching is Jonathan Jones kind of emerges here. What are they going to do about Patrick Chung? Because they need him in coverage to do what they want to do. Harmon is a better cover safety, and I'm wondering if Chung's been in the league for, I think, close to 10 years now, if not 10 years.
Yeah, he's a seasoned vet.
I wonder if his age is starting to show. It's worrying me because part of the reason they were so good on defense last year was Patrick Chung's emergence as a cover, or not as a cover safety, but having the ability to cover, to take a linebacker one-on-one. Now, Travis Kelce's one thing. I didn't expect him to shut out Travis Kelce, but Alvin Kamara, a rookie running back on a straight go, and you're going to get beat like that. He wasn't getting beat on that play last year. And Alvin Kamara, I liked what I saw from him, but he is not that kind of player.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think Patrick Chung's main thing should be coverage, though. I think he's a great open field tackler. I think he needs to, obviously have that skill set. And he didn't do a great job of it yesterday. I don't think that's going to be something that's going to, concern Belichick, concern Patricia all that much. I don't know. I think he got beat in that one play. Besides that, I think he made a couple really good open field tackles. I think him and McCourty are pretty good. Obviously, you have Harmon in there. You want to see him play a little bit more when you're heading in, when you have those situations where he does need to cover, a tight end, cover a running back. Chung got beat, but that's going to happen. That's just who he is, and I think you just got to deal with that and outweigh the positives with the negatives.
But overall, you know, we're nitpicking here. I think a well-rounded game from the Patriots yesterday. The one down we didn't touch on was Nate Solder. He got beat a couple of times again. But they don't, you know, I'm not going to talk much about it because he's the left tackle. There's really nobody else who's going to come in and grab that role on the roster right now. So that's a recap of the Patriots. If you want our recap on the rest of the NFL, we did a wrap-up show yesterday, as we do every Sunday night and will do every Sunday night throughout the NFL season. You can check that out on Twitter at Calling It Podcast or on our SoundCloud page. Also, make sure you subscribe on iTunes. The other Boston team was in action this weekend as well. Seems like the less attention there is on them, the better they play. They had a good week. We'll touch on that after the break. This is Calling It.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Football talk in the books. Of course, the Boston baseball team, the Red Sox, in action as well. Under the radar as the Patriots were coming off that bad loss. And it seems they play best when they're under the radar. They took 4 of 6 this week. They've won their last three series, 2-1. They're rolling a little bit, but with still 2 weeks to go, there's a lot to be decided. Joining us to break it down from 98.5 The Sports Hub is Matt McCarthy. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Always good to be on with you guys.
All right, so Matt, the first question is this. I think this is where everybody's mind is at right now. Red Sox are 6 games back of Houston for the 2 seed. It seems like after Cleveland's run, that's going to be the matchup in the first round. Home field advantage, oh so important. A 4-game series between the Red Sox and Houston to finish the series. In the 9 games between now and then, the Red Sox need to pick up 2 games to have a chance to catch the Astros. Can they do it?
Nope, not going to happen. Okay. 6 games back.
It's been good talking to you, Matt. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely right. Listen, how many do they have left? Like 13, something like that. 6 games back with under 15 to play, and I don't have the exact number in front of me. That's way too much to ask. Houston's not going to, you know, lose 10 out of 13 or anything like that.
Let me phrase it like this. They have 9 games left before the Houston series. They're back 6. Can they at least have a chance? Is it realistic to expect them to have a chance to go into that Houston series with playoff seeding on the line?
Yes. I mean, you know, in theory, if they're 6 back now, I mean, they could go back into that. You know, they could go into that series, you know, maybe down 4 with the chance to tie it up and take all 4 of those games. But even if they go into that series down 4, I don't see them taking sweeping the Houston Astros, even if it is at the end of the season. So I think there's no chance that they catch Houston for that second seed. I just think it's important that they play Houston in the first round, that Cleveland keeps winning, because I think Houston's a much better matchup for the Red Sox in the ALDS than the Indians are.
Before we get into some of the details of the end of the season, I just want to ask you this. Hypothetically, you could have between 7 and 9 games in a row between the Red Sox and the Astros with a 4-game series at the end and a best of 5 in the first round of the playoffs. In the sport of baseball, it's all about series, but 9 games in a row. Is that advantage Red Sox or advantage Astros playing that many times consecutively?
I'm going to go and say advantage neither, because I don't think that final series is going to matter for either team. So I don't think you're exactly going to see too many guys in that series who are going to be playing regularly in the playoffs. I mean, that series to me screams, you know, Saturday and Sunday, you're starting Hector Velazquez, you're starting Brian Johnson, you're starting anybody on your expanded roster, and nobody's really playing in that series at the end of it. So, yeah, that would be certainly odd that you would play the final you know, series of the season and then a playoff series against that team. It doesn't happen too often, I would imagine, just based on the way the scheduling works. But I think I don't see either team having a particular advantage with that.
Do you see David Price potentially starting in that final series just to see how he does in a starting outing?
I would not rule it out. And I know they're saying that he's going to be in the bullpen for the rest of the year, which is, you know, I think that's probably their plan. But let's see, he pitched 2 innings yesterday. Let's say he pitches 3 innings on Tuesday or Wednesday. And then all of a sudden you're kind of building up a little bit. You don't need him down the stretch. You don't need him to pitch big innings for you if you lock up the division. I could see them potentially stretching him out in that final series, maybe 4 or 5 innings. I mean, if he can get the 5 innings, most likely you're not going you know, 7 or 8 innings deep in the playoffs anyway with your starting pitcher. That's just not the way it works. I mean, the statistics, second time through the lineup and third time through the lineup, when it comes to starting pitchers in the playoffs, I mean, they're just staggering as to how those guys get rocked third time through the order. So we've seen it happen so much in baseball over the last few years that you really shorten up that starter and you go to the bullpen much earlier in the playoffs. If it gets to the point where they can get him, you know, stretched out to 5 innings in that final series, at least he gives you that option. I think that's what they'd like to do. I don't think they're going to tell anybody that because I think, you know, they know he can at least give them something out of the bullpen. But if they can stretch him out enough, maybe it gives them an option heading into the playoff rotation, because that is still so uncertain right now. You want to have as many options as possible.
Speaking of that rotation, as of right now, Chris Sale is scheduled to make 3 more starts this Wednesday, 1 next Tuesday, and then he's scheduled to start the final game of the year, Sunday, October 1st. That would be 2 days before the first playoff game. I'm going to guess that that's not going to happen. Do you see them just skipping that last start for Sale and having him have a gap between September 26th and October 3rd? Or will they rework this rotation? How could they rework this rotation, getting Chris Sale 3 more starts and having him available for the first game of the ALDS?
So if they have clinched the division by that point, there's no way he pitches a full game on that day. I could see them maybe sending him out there for an inning or two just to keep him fresh, just to get him a couple of innings of work. But you know, let's be honest, you know, that's the most you'll want to see from Chris Sale that final weekend of the year. If they feel that, you know, they need to do that so he doesn't have 10 days off in between starts, I get it. But you do not want to waste any of his bullets. We know he's certainly been better with extra rest this year. It looks like he's tiring. At least the numbers would indicate that he's tiring down the stretch. So you want to get him as much rest as possible. First and foremost, you got to wrap up the division. It's not, you know, done yet. They've got a 3-game lead with, 12 to play, I guess, 12, 13 to play. So you got to take care of business there. You've got, you know, a bunch of teams that they should handle pretty well until they get to that Astros series. The goal is wrap up the division before that final weekend of the year, and then you figure it out from there. And by figure it out, you know, that's an inning or two at the absolute most from a guy like Chris Sale, a guy like Drew Pomeranz, who's going to be your number 2 starter in the playoffs. Let's make sure that they have that luxury going into that final weekend.
How do you expect Chris Sale to pitch in the playoffs? You talk about how, you know, historically in September, he kind of phases out. Do you think he'll pick it back up come playoff time? This will be his first playoff appearance. Do you think he'll pick it up, or will that fatigue be a factor?
Put it this way, you know, I'm not to say concerned about his performance down the final, 2 months of the season. I'm more aware of it. I'm not going to, 100% say I'm concerned at this point. I think they have much bigger concerns going into the playoffs than Chris Sale. I would not at all be surprised if he goes out there and he picks it up again. I mean, we know how – look at him in the All-Star game. Look at him in big starts earlier in the year, and obviously, you know, how big can they truly be in April and May. This is a guy who gets amped up. Now, the concern is, does he get amped up like a guy like Jake Peavy and can't handle it in the playoffs? I think Chris Sale, to me, is the ultimate competitor. I think he'll be fine in the playoffs. I do, particularly if you can get him rest that final weekend going into the playoffs. If you can get him that extra rest – I think he's going to be fine in the playoffs. I think they have much bigger concerns than him.
And from their most important pitcher to maybe their most important hitter, Mookie Betts left the game this weekend. Thumb injury. He's listed as day-to-day. Again, they're balancing that 3-game division lead with trying to get healthy for this playoff run. How much Mookie Betts do we see over the final 2 weeks?
As much as you need him. You know, listen, it's a 3-game lead. You know, the last thing you want to do is go into that final series with the Astros and you don't have the division locked up, and the Yankees are right on your heels. Maybe they're tied. Maybe they even have a lead. The last thing you want to be doing is playing in a wild card game at this point. You got a 3-game lead. You've been a better team all year. You got to close this thing out. If he can play, he's got to play. You want to give him a night off tonight? That's fine. You know, maybe tomorrow night, that's fine. This is why you brought in a guy like Eduardo Nunez, who you can move around. Obviously, Nunez has been hurt, though. So there's that as well. But rosters are expanded. You can give him a night or two. But if he's healthy enough to play, he's got to be out there because you got to lock this thing up. You know, you can't rest until you get it. The whole goal is that you rest that final series of the year once you get that division locked up. And, you know, the problem with the Betts injury is he's finally starting to hit, and you always worry about thumbs, wrists, anything to do with the hand. That would be the big concern there. Look at what happened to a guy like Xander Bogaerts when he got hit on the wrist. So it happens, but you just have to hope that Mookie's okay, because they're going to need him in the playoffs. They need him to anchor that lineup.
And something I just want to mention real quick before we move on. The Yankees won the season series. Remember that. So what is a three-game lead is really more like a two-game lead, because if the Yankees tie it up, they have the head-to-head advantage. They would be the AL East champions.
Is that true, though? And I could be totally mistaken.
I looked it up last week. I'm pretty sure that's what it said.
Because it's for a division championship, though, so I'm very certain that they would play a head-to-head game, a tiebreaker game to determine
the
division champion. And then the loser of the tiebreaker game goes on and plays the wild card game that next night. I'm very certain that they do tiebreakers for divisions.
No, you know what? You're right. I remember what I was looking up now, and it was something else. You're right. And then, okay, so
your two best starters before the playoffs.
Let me ask you this before we move on. If you're the Red Sox, which game does Chris Sale start? Does he start the play-in? Does he start the wild card? Or does he start game one of the ALDS?
Well, put it this way. If you haven't had things locked up, chances are he's starting the final game of the season.
Oh, my God.
So in that case, now, let's see. Does Pomeranz, and I'm drawing a blank here, guys, is Pomeranz before or after Sale in the rotation?
Right now, Pomeranz is scheduled to start that second-to-last game, that Saturday.
Second-to-last game. So that would be,
That'd be September 30th, the Saturday.
That would be Eduardo Rodriguez, wouldn't it?
Eduardo Rodriguez would be, no, it would be.
No, that would be Rick Porcello starting the play-in game or the wild card
game. I remember why I looked it up. The Yankees would have home field advantage in the play-in because of the head-to-head record. So it would be Rick Porcello on the road in Yankee Stadium starting a winning in.
Yeah. So
you crying?
Take care of the division while you can. Take care of it while you can. The last thing you want to do is be playing play-in games to determine who's going to the wild card game. That is the last thing you want to do, because right now, as it lines up, it would be Porcello in that play-in game, and if you lose that, you're starting Eduardo Rodriguez in the wild card game. So yeah, let's lock that thing up beforehand, please.
Okay, so let's assume the Red Sox make the playoffs. Who's one guy that you think people will be surprised is left off the playoff roster?
Ooh, that's a good question. If Nunez, you know, is healthy and good to go, and they have their full complement of players, I'd like to see Brock Holt left off the roster. There's no need for a guy with a 690 OPS. Yeah, you can move him around the field, but that's Eduardo Nunez's job at this point. So I would like to see Holt left off the roster if they make it.
Anybody you think could be a surprise contributor, specifically in the bullpen, as that continues to kind of be a house of cards? Outside of Craig Kimbrel, anybody specifically, maybe an Austin Maddox or Robbie Scott kind of player that could come up big in the bullpen we're not looking at?
Well, the question is, how many lefties do you want to carry in the bullpen? Because if Price is going to be one of your lefties, I would imagine that Scott would be the second lefty. But, you know, do they only carry one? The bullpen all depends on how they want to use Price. If Price is strictly going to be a bullpen guy, and as I said, you know, earlier when we were chatting, you know, I'm not sure if they'll plan to do that. Of course, you also have, you know, you've got so many lefties in your starting rotation. You know, is Eduardo Rodriguez going to be a lefty out of the bullpen? So a guy like Robbie Scott could get left off the roster in favor of a lefty coming out of the starting rotation and going into the bullpen. Or do they simply leave a starter off the roster? Do they leave Doug Fister off the roster? Do they leave Eduardo Rodriguez off the roster, depending on who gets those starts? It all depends on how they want to line up that rotation. You know, a guy like Doug Fister, do you really need him in the bullpen if you're not going to carry him as a starter? You got a guy in Price who, if he's in the pen, will be stretched out. I don't know if you necessarily need a long man in that first series if Price is available and out of the bullpen. So a guy like Doug Fister, who we've all been talking about, is he going to get a playoff start? If he doesn't get a playoff start, he might not be on the roster. So there's a potential surprise as well.
We're talking to Matt McCarthy of 98.5 The Sports Hub. Matt, before we let you go, fines handed out to the Red Sox, also handed out to the New York Yankees. It seems like it was kind of reactionary. Who looks worse in this situation, the Red Sox or the Yankees?
I think they both look bad. I think the Red Sox look bad because they're too incompetent to cheat correctly. And, you know, and Lord knows they've been poor enough on offense this year. If you know what's coming, I can't even imagine how putrid they would be on offense if they didn't know it was coming. So the Red Sox look bad, and the Yankees, they just look like, you know, petulant children there. I mean, apparently, and that's how Rob Manfred treated this whole situation. He just laughed it off, issued some fines, and he said, well, you know, it's a competitive thing. I mean, you know, going back and fining the Yankees for using a dugout phone in previous seasons, I mean, that is the ultimate, you know, slap in the face of the Yankees. That's Major League Baseball telling them, listen, keep this in house. Don't embarrass us. Don't bring this, you know, situation out there. Don't go running and talking to the New York Times, a New York Times reporter who is breaking stuff like, you know, Jim Comey memos and Hillary Clinton emails. I mean, actually, that's the reporter, if I'm not mistaken, who broke the Red Sox Apple Watch gate thing or whatever you want to call it. So they both look really bad. How about that?
If only other commissioners knew how to squash issues like that and just kind of keep them out of the spotlight.
Well. Rob Manfred handled this beautifully. He really did. Yeah. I think Rob Manfred is the best commissioner in all of sports right now. I'm looking forward to the pitch clock next year. I can't wait for that. He gets what plagues baseball, and he's trying really hard to fix it. I think Rob Manfred has done an excellent job in his few years at the helm of Major League Baseball.
Well, we didn't have time to get to it this week, but there may be an opening for a commissioner in another league very soon, thanks to one Jerry Jones. So maybe Rob Manfred can handle double duty. He's Matt McCarthy. You can hear him on 98.5 The Sports Hub. Follow him on Twitter at MattMcCarthy98.5. Matt, we'll talk to you again during the playoffs.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks a lot.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
All right, getting ready to wrap it up here on Callin' It. Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz. There was a lot that happened, though, this weekend. A lot of fantastic finishes, specifically, that we're not going to get the time to fully delve into, but stuff we wanted to touch on. I know you did a rapid-fire segment a couple weeks ago when I wasn't here. What'd you call it?
The Other Topics segment.
The Other Topics. Okay.
So originally titled The Other Topics segment.
So we're going to do The Other Topics segment here, go through some of the finishes from this weekend, some other stuff too that went on. Let's start with the Cleveland Indians. I think it was Thursday night, so not quite this weekend, but they won their 22nd straight game. That was in extra innings. Then they lost the 23rd. Do you think they have the all-time record? It's been interesting. I've been following this. So I think it was the New York Giants won in air quotes 26 straight, but there was a tie in there, although they still counted as a winning streak. I don't know. I think you give it to the Cleveland Indians.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's modern-day baseball, too. I think it's a lot more – it's a lot harder to do nowadays than it was back then. But I don't think this is something – like, if I was a fan of the Indians, I'd be worried because I feel like whenever a team has a run like this
– you buy into peaking too early?
I think so. I mean, because the team that held the record before them in the AL was the Oakland Athletics. That was, what, 2002? They went on to lose in the ALDS,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's the Oakland Athletics.
I get that, but this is a team. And last year, the Red Sox in September won, like, what, 10 straight games, 9 straight games? See what happened to them the week before the season. That carried over. I feel like that they're not going to play better baseball than what they just did. Maybe they're a team of destiny, but maybe I'm just a pessimist. I don't think this is something that's going to be carried over into the playoffs. I don't think they're going to be able to build off of that.
Look, I'd rather win 22 straight in September than give up a walk-off grand slam the night I clinch the division and lose my last six to close out the regular season. Let's put it that way.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
And they are probably my World Series favorites right now, I think, because they're rebounding well. They've won a couple of games.
I mean, it's not the Dodgers anymore.
Right, exactly. I think there's teams collapsing that are collapsing. Well, the Indians, they just lost one game.
But the Dodgers also proved my point. They were on an incredible
run.
Yeah,
they were too hot. There is such a thing as being too hot too early. I don't think September is too early. I think, you know, June, July is too early.
Yeah.
College football, a couple of awesome endings, another great week of college football. There's a lot of games we could talk about. We're going to stick with two of them. First off, Tennessee and Florida, the Hail Mary late. All the credit in the world to Butch Jones for putting Florida in that spot. The guy may be the worst coach in the SEC. He's the reason that they lost. Was it Riley Ferguson, the quarterback from Memphis, who went toe-to-toe with Josh Rosen this weekend, came out of nowhere? Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of his now after watching that. But Tennessee, Florida, that was some ending. And I was talking to a big Gators fan yesterday who filled me in on some of the stuff I'd missed. I was working a game while that was going on. It was the biggest recruiting weekend of the year for Florida.
Really?
And all the top recruits are sitting first row right behind the end zone where that ball was caught.
So it's the perfect scenario for that team.
Gators football might be back in a year or two.
Yeah, potentially. All you need is those recruits to sign on. And after a game like that, I'd probably be ready to sign the commitment letter.
Yeah, Butch Jones, though, that is a bad football coach. That is a bad football coach they have in Tennessee.
Let me ask you this. Do you think college has better coaches than the NFL for football?
There's more coaches. It's different because I think there's a lot of college coaches or NFL coaches who are great coaches, but they wouldn't be. Like, Belichick wouldn't be able to recruit. He wouldn't have success in college.
Yeah, that's
He's
true.
The greatest NFL coach of all time, whereas you have coaches like
Pete Carroll, obviously, would be good in college.
Right. But you have coaches like Urban Meyer, who his whole strength, Harbaugh, his whole strength is in the ability to recruit. He's not necessarily that great of a football coach.
What about
He's just
Saban?
A recruiter.
Because Saban, he was an NFL coach at one point.
Yeah, he sucked.
Yeah.
His whole style of coaching won't fly with NFL players. It's just college kids.
But wouldn't you say the same thing about a guy like Belichick?
It's the other way around. Yeah, Belichick wouldn't be able to coach in college.
I feel like they're kind of similar in their hard-assedness.
Where did Saban learn it all? He was on Belichick's staff in Cleveland in the 90s.
That's true.
The other game, USC and Texas, a rematch of what some call the greatest college football game ever played. Granted, that was like 10 years ago now, I think, 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The Reggie Bush Trojans against the Vince Young Longhorns. Vince Young was there. Texas was in it late. It was flashing back to last year, Texas Notre Dame. Texas is back, folks. They were not back. They blew that game. They should have gone for two, in my opinion. At the end of overtime there. But look, Darnold didn't look good in that game at all. Rosen struggled at times. All the top college quarterback prospects struggled. Mason Rudolph is climbing his way up the Heisman ladder and up the Lamar Jackson stunk. That was a name I couldn't remember. Mason Rudolph is climbing that ladder, not only the Heisman ladder, but the NFL draft ladder too. I loved what I saw from him against Pitt. Another week where it's the offensive line unable to protect these top quarterback recruits around the nation. It just shows you how important an offensive line is to a quarterback.
Yeah. I mean, that's the most important thing to a quarterback, and you see a lot with a lot of these guys. Although having a bad offensive line kind of does show you how these quarterbacks do under pressure, and that's valuable. So some of these coaches might be taking that as a positive in this scenario.
And aside from all that, Darnold and Rosen, and we'll wait and hear about Jackson, we'll wait and hear about some of these other guys, but Darnold and Rosen, it sounds like they've been watching the Jets, and they may want to stay in college another year, which would be awesome.
They're probably throwing games so that they move
down
the draft
board. I want
the
Jets to take Lamar Jackson with the top pick badly because he is Geno Smith. Geno Smith 2.0.
I just want whoever they take to not play well.
Lamar Jackson is that guy. Good college quarterback. He can't make the throws an NFL quarterback needs to make. Watch both his games against Clemson last year and this year. To the NFL, we did most of our recap yesterday. You can check that out on our SoundCloud page and on iTunes. But the game we didn't get to talk about because it was Sunday night was the Falcons and the Packers. It was a blowout for most of it, but the Packers almost came back. The Falcons finally figured out the clock.
Yeah, they decided they found out how to run the ball, which is always good. And I think this proves that the Falcons are not hung up on last season. They still have a top three offense in the NFL, maybe even number one. And two things, and also you look at how the Seahawks played the week after that game and how the Packers played the week after that week one matchup. Maybe both of those teams aren't where they need to be at this point of the season. Maybe they're just a step behind. Again, I said last night the Seahawks will get back to their normal, you know, status. They'll be the Seahawks we know. It's the same thing with the Packers. They're both talented
teams.
They
got banged up last night, though. They lost. Jordan Nelson didn't play. They had a couple more receivers go down. Devon House, one of the better defensive players, got hurt. They're kind of right there with the Patriots in terms of the injuries early in the season. Not some great not great finishes necessarily, but just some other stuff over the weekend we wanted to touch on. We're a radio talk show, so we got to touch on the Emmys. I didn't watch much. I'm not a big award show guy, but I thought Sean Spicer was funny. I know some people are...
Yeah.
Unhappy with
God.
That, and we're not going to go into that. But
you know,
Melissa McCarthy was laughing, and that ultimately is what made it funny for me.
Yeah, it was awkward. It looked awkward. It was funny. You know what? I mean, I understand how people look at Sean Spicer and what they associate him with, but it was funny. Like, just admit it was funny. Stop being like so serious all the time. It's the Emmys, and the one thing they do at these award shows is they're just so pretentious. It's like I don't want to hear from you on politics. I'm sorry. Like, I might agree with you, I might not. Who cares? you're an actor. You don't like you. Right. You're not real world.
I can't remember the name of the actor. He's from This Is Us, the main actor from This Is Us, and his name is escaping me right now. But they cut him off on his acceptance speech. He actually wasn't being political at all. They cut him off on his acceptance speech.
And Nicole Kidman went on for a while.
He was great. And then they let him finish his acceptance speech in a press conference backstage.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's weird. They, I feel like they have different standards for different people. But I love when they play the music, though.
I do, universally, because it's you know, these guys are Hollywood actors, and to see them get shamed like that is funny. But I thought Sean Spicer was great. Kevin Durant last night took to Twitter. Didn't realize he was taking to Twitter. Apparently has a Skip Bayless fake account he uses to defend himself. Didn't change over. Embarrassing look for him.
To say the least. And this, I love it because I just want to, I haven't gone on Twitter and looked into this too much, but I want to see all the KD defenders come out and say, he's not soft. I do this too.
But like, how do you know it's not him?
How do I know? Oh, the it's KD defenders.
KD defending the KD defender.
That'd be great. It's yeah, it's
a little
it's KD Twitterception. Yeah.
A little trollception. And then not this weekend, this morning, we had this. Hang on. Listen to this right here.
For you. And your representatives met with ownership and let them know that you wanted out?
No.
Why not?
Why would I have to?
If you don't speak to somebody about it, they might take it personally.
Yeah.
Do you care about that at all?
No.
That was Kyrie Irving this morning on First Take talking with Stephen A. Smith. And, of course, that was about LeBron James.
Can I just say, it sounds like a parent like punishing their kid. Like, do you feel bad about that? No. Like, he's just not apologizing.
Listen, he didn't say it like, no. He said it with a smile on his face.
But it was just such a funny tone. I've watched it. Right. That's the first time I've listened to it without a visual.
You got to watch it with the visual because he's so happy to say he didn't care about telling LeBron that he was leaving. He didn't care about telling anybody on the Cavs who wasn't on a need-to-know basis that he was leaving. The Celtics played inspired basketball for the last couple years. But what they were doing in 2007 and those teams that they haven't done since is play pissed off basketball. Kyrie's pissed. He is not happy he had to go through what he went through this offseason. I cannot wait to watch the Celtics play angry basketball with an edge.
He just pissed off LeBron James, though. You understand that. Like, that's a direct shot at LeBron.
Yes, and I am so here for that.
It will be a great one-season rivalry until LeBron ditches Cleveland again.
And you know what? Maybe then it's a finals rivalry. Maybe.
If he goes to the West Coast. I think that's where he's going.
Well, he's going to the West Coast. He's not staying in the East if he leaves Cleveland.
Yeah, he shouldn't.
I think that's a foregone conclusion, but we'll see. I just love how bitter Kyrie is. As a bitter, crotchety person myself, I love that he is going to hold this grudge over LeBron for the fact that he's not as good as him.
I think there's a turn in the NBA, and Dirk talked about this, Dirk Nowitzki, about how it's not about loyalty to the team, it's loyalty to yourself and winning and making money. And I still have a problem with what KD did, even though some would put what he did in that category. I think it was weak and soft. But most other players, if you go elsewhere and get more money for it, that's the way it is. Or if you want to get the ball more, so you want to leave a certain team, it's about what's best for you and self-interest. And I think that's a new wave of the NBA coming forward now.
So we are back. That's going to do it for us this week. We are back next week. It will be our final show. What did I miss?
Triple G. And
oh, my Canelo. God. Oh, my God. I was going through my notes. I forgot to write it down. I've been – oh. I screwed that up, didn't I? Let's call it a draw. Yeah, great fight. Awesome fight. Everything I wanted it to be. Canelo came out early. He came out strong. Triple G started to wear him down. That guy's chin is amazing. I don't think anybody knew that going into this fight.
He went in. He would get punched so hard, just like power punches left and right, and he'd keep approaching. I don't get how he kept the pressure on like that.
Great fight. Everybody loved it. But, of course, it was boxing had to screw it up.
Yep.
Adelaide Bird, the bad card. She has a history of this. Her husband is a referee. That is how she keeps getting work. It's a problem. I'm just going to co-sign on just about everything Teddy Atlas and Stephen A. Smith said after the fight. The good news, there will be a rematch, and it should be popular.
There would have been one anyway, though. Like, I'm really upset, and this kind of proves my point that boxing is just, it's turned into a gimmicky sport. And that was an amazing fight we saw on Saturday night. But to see it ruined by officiating,
Okay, I don't like that term. It wasn't ruined. The fight was still a great fight.
The fight was great, but that was Triple G's win. To see it taken away from him like that, even the guy who ruled it a draw, you're wrong. Like, it seemed pretty clear who won that fight and who won the majority of those rounds.
I understand. I don't agree with the draw. I understand it.
It's better than 118-110
right.
Canelo.
The power punches Canelo was landing early, he may have won some of the rounds 10-8. And that, I think that's where the draw came from. I don't think it was necessarily number of rounds. I think it was because Canelo was dominating at the beginning. And I understand. I think I had him at 10-8.
He had a resurgence at the end,
I think it was
too.
The second round. And he did, yeah. Not necessarily a 10-8 resurgence, but he won a couple there late. I had Triple G with 5 of the last 6. But look, people saying it's fixed. 118-110 isn't fixed. No. That's like going in to rob a bank and checking out your hair in the security camera reflection.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just beyond stupid. The name CJ Ross will stand out to some people. That was from the Mayweather fight a couple years ago that was ruled a draw.
What about the Pacquiao one? That he
Pacquiao,
lost?
Jeff Horn. I can't remember the name of the judge in that. Well, that was a couple of judges because Horn won. That wasn't even a draw. Ultimately, and this has always been a reason boxing isn't so popular, it's not necessarily decided in the ring. I thought Chris Mannix had a great point on Twitter. Saturday night, maybe you switch to a 5-judge panel for these title fights. It at least, you know, it will help avoid some of that because 4 out of 5 judges, 9 out of 10, 99 out of 100, every judge versus Mrs. Bird would score that in favor of Golovkin or at least a draw. So they need to do something about it. It's more than, look, Adelaide Bird screwed up. That's a terrible card. She should not officiate. I don't care if it's peewee boxing, if it's 13-year-olds in a training gym in Lowell. She should not be officiating any more fights.
It's pretty good boxing, though.
But it's a bigger issue. Yeah, nothing against Lowell boxing. Pride of Lowell, Mickey Ward, he's awesome. It was a great movie. Don't forget Dickie Ward, too.
Dick Eklund,
that's right. Yeah. Thank you. Knocked out. Who'd he knock down?
Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray, yep.
Yeah.
Not the band, the boxer. Where was I going with this? Yes, boxing needs to do something bigger picture about the power officials, officials, and by officials I mean scorers, judges, have over these fights. It's a bigger problem than Adelaide Bird. She unfortunately is just, she's the main symptom. She's the main that you can look at her and see where this problem
is. She's the most recent example.
Most recent, and the most egregious.
Yeah, of boxing messing up.
118-110, like. That's 2 rounds. That's 2 rounds for Golovkin. He nearly knocked Alvarez down in 4 separate rounds.
Yeah.
I don't know what the heck, and it sucked, because I want to talk more about the fight and the fact nobody got knocked down and I was shocked and Golovkin's chin, but you have to talk about it and it sucks because that was a great fight and Adelaide Bird ruined it. Hopefully she is as far away from the rematch as possible.
Yeah, oh yeah. They'll know not to put her there.
And let's get Tony Weeks in as the official.
Yeah.
So it's just my favorite boxing guy. He's got the most pristine mustache.
Does he?
You've ever seen, yeah.
I'm not super well versed on boxing.
Tony Weeks, Google it.
I definitely will. They just need, there's going to be a rematch and it's going to be awesome. Still to me, Triple G won this fight. And I think it would have added more if it was ruled that way.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. So now we're going to have a fight to see who the real winner is, like the real quote unquote winner is.
There'll be three of these. I think there's going to end up being 3 of these because whoever wins the next one, then there'll be the redemption match. Yeah, but
that's probably why.
As a Triple G fan, I'm just glad he's still undefeated. All right, we get everything?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us for this week. Then next week, there'll be 1 week left until the MLB playoffs. The Red Sox will have a huge series with the Astros coming up. Maybe a chance to take home field advantage in the first round of that series.
Seems like they're going to be the matchup. Yeah.
A lot of baseball talk going on, so that could end up being.
Let's say they go to the ALDS.
Well, let's say they go 5 games. We could have 9 games in a row between the Houston Astros and the Boston Red Sox.
Ugh.
they play the Astros well, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, you got Justin Verlander back in that rotation, too, with the Astros. So
little Justin Verlander.
Dallas Keuchel.
Dave Dombrowski, Justin Verlander reunion.
Oh, yeah.
All right, well, more on that next week. Patriots talk as well. Inching closer to Bruins and Celtics season. We'll start bringing them back up in the coming weeks. To make sure you hear all of that, follow us on Twitter at Colnett Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe on SoundCloud as well. Follow him on Twitter at
Alex_Lebowitz.
Me at the_real_Alex_B because I made it in middle school and it sucks. So make sure to stay tuned throughout the week and join us Sunday night for our NFL roundup. That will be whenever the final 4 o'clock game ends, assuming there's no more lightning delays that suck. Yeah. Anyways, we'll talk to you next week. He's Alex Lemowitz. I'm Alex Barth. This has been Calling It. Bye.